This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul, the first of 2024, on Lough Éilí Breida, with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Now, this evening, we mark the 1500th anniversary of the passing of St. Bridget, Ireland's most notable female saint. But who was she? A figure of history or of myth and legend? A goddess and or a feminist icon? Or possibly a combination of all of the above? Now, to unravel these mysteries, I'm joined by Edel Brannock, author of Monasticism in Ireland, AD 900 to 1250. And that will be published shortly. That word beloved of publishers, by Four Courts Press. Yes. And of course, Edel also has an article in the next issue of History Ireland. You can hold up the cover there, Edel. There we go. That will be dropping through the letterbox of all you subscribers in the audience. I know you're all subscribers. And Elva Johnston, Associate Professor of Medieval Irish History at University College Dublin. And of course, this is Elva's second HedgeGhoul. She was here several years ago in the same venue on St. Patrick. And he may feature in tonight's discussion as well. And on my right, Niamh Witcherly, who lectures in medieval Irish history at Maynooth University. And finally, Barbara Niamh Lynn, Associate Professor of Folklore at University College Dublin. And actually a neighbour of mine, I just discovered. I didn't realise who she was, actually. Anyway, that's another story. You're in parallel universes. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the National Library of Ireland. Now, Edel, just let's start off, because we're here on the 1st of February, which is supposedly the date on which St. Bridget died. And the Irish annals recall that she was born in AD 439, died in AD 524, which means she was 85 when she died, which is a fair old age. Now, in my innocence, that would seem to me to mean she's actually a real person. We know when she was born, we know when she died. Is that the case?
Well, on the basis of the dates, you wouldn't be too sure, because that early period in the annals, well, we can't say for definite, you know, that these dates are absolute. Although, on the other hand, the death date, sort of 524, is quite plausible. I mean, if you only look at when St. Patrick might have been, when Christianity was coming to Ireland, it fits okay. The main, and I suppose this is my interest in her, some aspect of her historicity, or, you know, that she is a genuine historical figure, is to do with her genealogies. In the lives, and Elva, I'm sure, will explain about the lives and so on, but there are references to who she belonged to.
Just stop you. What's a genealogy for
a genealogy? A genealogy is that the pedigree,
right?
What her family was, who is descended, okay. Who she belonged to. And we are really, really lucky in Ireland that we have pedigrees or genealogies of the peoples of Ireland. Right back to this period, and then with their sort of ancestors.
Presumably these must be used with caution, because people could invent a genealogy.
Yes, they could, and they did, and they changed genealogies, and, you know, depending on what was happening politically, people were taken in and taken out. But the good thing about the Irish genealogies is that when it comes to people like the Fothert, whom Bridget belonged to, an early people, important for all sorts of reasons, but early, they're not erased from the record. They're kept. And in the case of the Fothert, for some reason, an extensive genealogy exists. So we have all their different branches, and she is in among them as, you know, genuinely one of a member of one of the branches of the Fothert. And I should say, people who are from County Carlow or County Wexford, the Barony of Forth exists, and that is from the name Fothert.
Well, when you say the Fothert, well, a people, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they are a group. We used to call them tribes. We don't tend to use the word tribe nowadays, but a lot of people understand that better than. So a whole group of connected families who are living In this area around Kildare, if you go from Crohan Hill in County Offaly, well, the border, it's a border, right across to even Maynooth, they're there. So they hold that territory, or that's where they're settled.
No, our cartographer did a very nice map.
He did.
But that's the basic area.
That's the basic area, yes, yes.
So modern County Kildare and
Kildare and bits of others. So she's in there in one as one of a member of one of the dynasties of the Fothart. And that sort of anchors her very much in history.
And like what, as I understand it, different tribes or whatever you want to call them, right, specialised in certain areas, whether it be the church or whatever. So what did the Fothart do? What was their unique selling point?
In the genealogies, they are supposed to be the defenders of Leinster. You know, that they defend the borders of Leinster, because you also have them down in Wexford and you have them up further into Meath and even further north. But what I am beginning to understand in the context of Bridget, and we might come back to this because it's highly complicated, is that they are in charge of, or custodians of, this very important ceremonial landscape, which is the Curra, Crohan Hill, the Hill of Allen, covered in archaeology, and that the Fothart are like other early people who are kind of the OPW of these areas, you know, in guarding.
So they're the guardians of the past.
Yes.
If we might put it that way.
Yes, yeah. And this ritual landscape. And plonk in the middle of it is Kildare. So, you know, the association between her people and this area is rooted in history.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to come back to this because you've raised geography and I want to come on to archaeology shortly. But before that, I want to go to Elva on the sources for Bridget. You know, what sources have we? I mean, and like, are they reliable, you know?
Well, what I would sort of begin with is saying what don't we have almost? The sources on Bridget from a very early point are extremely extensive. She's the first Irish person that other Irish people write about in detail. And, you know, that's absolutely remarkable because she's a woman. It's a very gendered, it's a highly patriarchal and elitist society. But Bridget, from an early point, is somebody that they write about. By the middle of the 7th century, there's at least two traditions, written traditions in existence about Bridget. To begin with, they're written in Latin. And Latin, if you think about texts in Latin, it's going to be more for an ecclesiastical audience. But at the same time, people could take a Latin text and they could read it out in Irish. So texts create communities of people who engage with those texts. They're not necessarily just closed off for an elite. So by the 7th century, there is a multitude of texts written about Bridget in Latin. They're also writing about her in Irish as well. And Adele referenced the Fothart and an absolutely fascinating link between Bridget and the Fothart. One of the earliest texts we have about Bridget is a sort of an archaic poem in the genealogies. And in that poem, which is around the same date as these early lives, you're already getting that description of connecting Bridget with Kildare, the idea of Bridget being so important, she's like another Virgin Mary, that Bridget is somebody with political power and influence. She's also the first Irish saint who has narrative texts written about her in Irish. So at every point, she's actually out there in the field before Patrick is. She's almost certainly the most popular Irish saint of that period. We can see it in the huge number of dedications to Bridget, and we can see this in that multitude of literature. She's also one of the first Irish saints to get lives written about her on the continent. And I know Niamh might mention her research in Florence, an early life written by an Irish bishop there, Donatus of Fiesole. So she's somebody who attracts a huge literature. The literature is in Irish and Latin. It's in formal lives, it's in hymns, it's in poems. She begins to appear in saga-like literature as well. So her tradition doesn't remain the same. And this is the other really important thing, is Bridget is reinvented generation after generation. So there's sort of an early Bridget you can look at, sort of in the genealogies, as Adele mentioned, in those early lives. those lives then develop and take on a life of their own. And I'd like to take one example to show you how Bridget changes and develops over time. So in one of these early lives, it describes how Bridget is veiled as a nun. And she's veiled by bishops, and there's lots of miracles, as you would expect, around the veiling. By the 9th century, one of these bishops is drunk with the grace of God, and she is given the honour of a bishop. A century later, they're actually saying it's not just Bridget, it's Bridget's successors as well. So it's a very vibrant cult. It changes over time, and it's something that never remains in the same place. So it's absolutely fascinating.
But we've nothing by her herself. Like St. Patrick.
No, we don't.
But St. Patrick
it's worth saying, though, I think in that point, in terms of the amount of doubt that's cast on the existence of Bridget, is Patrick is the only saint from that era we have any writings from. And yet there's a multitude of other saints around the same time as Bridget or a bit after, and no doubt is cast upon their existence. And in fact, there's far fewer sources for them. She's probably the saint we have from that era with the greatest volume of sources available.
Well, can I leave open my name and just kind of explore the doubt thing for a second, right? Could it be that, are they writing about a real person, or could they be writing about a sort of a pre-Christian entity of some sort?
I'll be honest. I think they're writing about a real person. Okay. I think if you look at the early lives of Bridget, I'll just mention one of them. It's the most Kildare-centred of them. It's written by a Kildare cleric, Cogitosis. He's writing about a Christian saint. A lot of the miracles that people think are very unusual for Bridget, the ones related to agriculture or the rhythm of sort of daily life, are ones that can be paralleled in the lives of other female saints elsewhere. I mean, the lives of Patrick are actually much more unusual in content than the Bridget lives. So they are writing about a saint. The first evidence that we get that there might be a pre-Christian tradition is as late as the 10th century. And at that point, the volume of material that exists for the saint far outstrips the volume of material that exists for a pre-Christian figure. It's about 4 or 5 lines in a long encyclopedic text, which is full of, I would say, you know, fantastical but also fascinating features and has a great interest in the pre-Christian past. It's called Cormac's Glossary. You can access it online. I'd actually really advise people to look at it. It's a treasure trove of information, and it gives us a sense of how the Irish think about their own past. But that's it, basically. And the evidence for a pre-Christian cult is something which really can only exist by co-opting the biography of the saint and saying that's the biography of the goddess. And this is something that happens in the 1860s. We can sort of more or less date it. Maud Gonne takes up the writings of Whitley Stokes, and she very much promotes the idea of a pagan goddess, Bridget, because it's non-sectarian. And it's taken up by the cultural revival thereon. But before that, there's very little doubt around the fact that there is a Christian saint.
I want to go to Niamh, but just before that, I just realised I forgot to explain to people that you're actually a school here, right? That, you know, you have to actually pay attention, because you will be expected to contribute to the discussion here, right? But there may be people who have never been at a head school before. No one is safe in this room, right? Just to let you know. And so it's not just a Q&A at the end. So if you want to ask a question at any stage, just put your hand up and you can enter the discussion.
Just one thing just to add to that is one of the reasons I sort of emphasise the malleability of Bridget's cult is one of the things we do see with Christianity is that various types of traditions do get co-opted in. And I think the best example of that is probably the Imbolc 1st of February. So, I mean, you can have that and at the same time acknowledge the historicity of the saint.
They're not mutually exclusive.
They're not mutually exclusive.
You know, different ideas.
Yeah.
Steve, you want to come in on the something that Elvin was saying? This research you referred to, what's that about? I mean, that's an interesting one where you have something on the continent.
Basically, I think what Elva is trying to explain there is, and I think actually, basically, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence for Bridget, especially in literature. You know, she just inspired so much literature. I think actually it's something that goes against her for modern scholars. I think she's kind of not been done dirty a little bit by modern scholars. And I think it's just how much information there is on Bridget that other figures are maybe a little bit easier to get a hold of. You know, so if you want to be to understand anything about Bridget, you just need, there's so much for you to study. What Elva was referring to there was just that very quickly the cult of Bridget starts to spread around Europe. So again, you know, she becomes, you know, the most famous Irish person in a way, kind of around Europe quite quickly. So like for the earliest evidence of her relic cult outside of Ireland is as early as probably the year 700 AD, where we have this relic tag turning up in the Abbey of St. Maurice d'Agon in Switzerland. But then there's lots of other kind of later on, there's different places become famous for having the relics of Bridget as well. So, you know, you've Bruges that has the mantle of Bridget, fragments of her skull near Lisbon and Portugal.
How does the skull of St. Bridget get to Lisbon?
That's a trade in relics and everything. That's a conversation for another day, I think. But what Elva was referring to there was I was just flown in, you know, from Florence. I was speaking there about St. Bridget, but I was also studying some manuscripts in the Laurentian Library in Florence on St. Bridget. So one of the most famous, I don't know if you know that we... Part of the reason why Ireland gained the reputation as the island of saints and scholars is because so many Irish people, Irish men mainly, left Ireland. They were kind of called peregrini, kind of exiles and pilgrims, but essentially they were leaving Ireland in, for different reasons, perhaps the pursuit of knowledge, spreading the Christian faith. But one of the most famous of these scholars was Donatus, and he became Bishop of Fiesole, which is just there next to Florence. And he wrote a very famous metrical life, a very unique, a kind of a poem, really, over 2,000 lines, a metrical life of Bridget. And then a prose life of Bridget is also attributed to him. But that's from the 9th century. She continued to inspire literature, you know, so from maybe 600, the precursors to Cogitosis and everything, you know, till today.
What makes a good cult?
You need to have a good person, a good figure, a good figure that we can all, someone that you can live up to, and someone who is very well written about.
I mean, she's not martyred or anything, you know. I mean, do you know what I mean?
No, so you need to just have an inspirational individual, and you need to have very clever individuals promoting that inspirational individual.
Right.
That's all it takes. And Bridget had some of the best, especially in Cogitosis. And she had the most important element to me in Maynooth University and in Kildare is that Kildare had the body of Bridget and her Bishop Conlade, which they displayed to great effect in the Church of Kildare. And Cogitosis tells us that this drew people from all over Ireland to come and venerate at the tomb of Bridget. And
that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I have tried to find what happened. I don't know, does anybody know what happened? At some point, Kildare really has a series of unfortunate events in the 12th century. Lots of things conspire against the power base is moved away from the traditional power base of the Church of Kildare, the reformation of the church, Dermod MacMurrah, that old baddie, he plays a part, the Anglo-Norman invasion, lots of things happen.
So something lost it, basically.
Well, and maybe it was earlier, it's just really hard to know. Apparently John de Courcy, faked, discovering the relics of Patrick and Bridget and Columbkill in the 12th century and interring them in Downpatrick.
Now, mention of Florence and Italy, I just want to get this one out of the way. Technically, she's not a saint at all, though, is she?
She's in the liturgy.
Has she been beatified?
Yeah, she's in the.
Because I know there are lots of Irish saints
She's in the calendar. She's in the Irish calendar, and
yeah, but she's not canonized as such.
But none of them are from that period. Yeah, so
St. Malachy is.
And she's not Italian, right?
So no, she's on
80% of saints are Italian, apparently.
No, but she's on an equal footing with. She's on an equal footing with all of the other Irish saints from the same period. We're putting, much later ideas of canonization onto a period that didn't have it. So she has not been downgraded or not had the same status of any of her peers at the time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, should she be canonized?
But again, that would be putting a process, I suppose, a modern process on an early medieval.
She
should. Sorry, that's the short answer.
Yeah, right.
She should definitely be canonized.
Start a campaign. Did you want to ask a question there? Yeah.
Just about the influence in the continent. Would Bridget of Sweden be connected through that cult?
So I don't know if anyone else has another idea on this. I've been thinking a lot about all these other Bridgets lately, just because I've come from Faisalay and they have a Bridget, a 9th century Bridget, who scholars keep telling them is just a manifestation of the Kildare saint. And they're upset about that, understandably. Probably there was, at a minimum, I now believe, in a lot of these places, and perhaps the same thing in Sweden, where what you have is a woman there who's doing really good work, right? Who's either founding a community or building a community or doing a lot in her community. And then that's happening in a lot of different places. And Bridget just becomes kind of an avatar or whatever for all of the work of kind of some of these different women. And they're kind of then supplanted, you know, that's put onto it. Now, Idel, you know more about Bridget. Bridget of Sweden.
Yes, I think what the case is with the Scandinavian countries is that the Scandinavians from Dublin right through Chester, London, and especially through the Western Isles of Scotland up into Scandinavia, take her as one of their patrons. So hence you find all those Kilbrides, for example, in Scotland, and you have Brideswell and so on. So this is how the cult, and one of the earliest depictions of her is an altar from, it's in the museum in Copenhagen, in Aarhus, from Aarhus, where she's with St. Thecla. Mm-hmm. They're together, and that's 12th century, so that's early enough, because the other patron that the Scandinavians, especially Norwegians, have is Saint Sunniva. And Saint Sunniva didn't exist at all, but she was made into an Irish princess who was martyred. So there's this kind of influence in the Christianity of the Scandinavian countries, or the lands of the Scandinavians.
Article on her in History Ireland as well in the last year.
And just to add to that as well, and sort of going back to the point Niamh was making about, you know, are you a saint or are you not a saint? She also makes her way into sort of liturgies, particularly in Germany. And what happens is they have shortened versions of the lives of Bridget, and they make their way through an awful lot of manuscripts. So there's a good number of manuscripts of the actual Irish lives, but there's a lot more of these shortened lives or anecdotes about Bridget, and she's incorporated then liturgically into these various churches. So she ends up having quite a significant footprint.
If I could just make a comment there as well, and this is kind of getting back to what Adele was saying a moment ago about Sunniva and so on, and this is getting very much into my own area, I suppose, of folklore and ethnology, because we all know that interesting and all is the actual historical facts behind St. Bridget are, it's actually people's perceptions of things and what people believed happened on any given occasion, and what people make of things, that is really of huge importance as well. And that would certainly apply to the figure of St. Bridget and the way in which she has developed over the years, and the way in which she has very much entered into the kind of popular consciousness and grasped the popular imagination in a huge way. So I suppose, as I say, coming from a folkloristic perspective, the actual facts of the matter are of secondary importance. It's how she developed and how belief in her developed over the years, and the kind of narratives that grew up about her that are particularly fascinating, I think. And if I could just comment as well on something that Elva was saying there a moment ago, kind of compare and contrast Patrick and Bridget, which is a very interesting kind of an exercise as well on many levels and in many ways. But there is this kind of, in popular tradition and in popular belief and practice and so on, there is this kind of atmosphere of ancientness about St. Bridget, which you don't get to the same extent about St. Patrick. And that is exemplified very, very clearly by the fact that today is the 1st of February, which is the Feast of St. Bridget, as we all know. But actually, the really important occasion in tradition was, in many parts of the country, for many of the practices that attached to the occasion, was last night. It was January the 31st, which is the eve of the Feast of St. Bridget. Now, nobody has ever asked you what you're going to do or how you're going to celebrate whatever the 16th of March. I mean, Patrick is very, very much connected to the day of the 17th of March, whereas Bridget seems to reflect an older, probably Judeo-Christian reckoning of time, whereby any given occasion or festive occasion was believed to have started on the eve before, of the eve of the day rather, which does seem to suggest a kind of a more ancient
past attaching to Bridget, which in turn ties into the whole notion of the Christian Bridget as being a kind of a development or transmogrification or whatever of an older pre-Christian goddess figure, which, I mean, we don't know for definite, but obviously it's an argument that has been put forward by many people.
And I think another factor to throw into the mix, I probably do sound pretty obsessed on the Bridget Patrick comparison, but I suppose the way you've been thinking about things, I've been sort of thinking about that for a while. And I think one of the key issues is that Patrick is always seen as a figure of ecclesiastical authority. His cult doesn't actually change hugely. If you look at the different iterations of his cult over time, the way Patrick is portrayed, I mean, Patrick himself is completely different, obviously, but the way the Patrick of the legend is portrayed is remarkably consistent. It's about authority, it's about power, it's about elites. Bridget's cult is much more rooted in the lives of ordinary people, and it is from the very beginning. So I think the constituency for Bridget and the constituency for Patrick are quite different. And Bridget is shown, even in these early lives, as being opposed to the elites often, or, you know, standing up for ordinary people against the way they're expressing their power. So I think they're very antithetical cults in some ways.
I just want to pick up something that Barbara said there and pitch this to Adele, right? This is what you're suggesting is that the Christian Bridget is kind of latched on to an earlier, you know, pre-Christian idea. No, because I want to pitch to you is the process of Christianization, right? Because, I mean, presumably St. Patrick didn't just come in and Christianize Ireland in a few days, you know, and banish the snakes and the druids and whatever. But Bridget surely must have been around when the whole thing was in a state of flux.
Absolutely. And now this may sound like a series of footnotes, but what I think is happening is, first of all, Leinster is being Christianized either at the same time or even earlier from a different perspective. Potentially from Palladius, who is mentioned as having been sent by the Pope to those believing in Christ. And the likely place in which that happened was in Leinster. We also have a companion saint for Bridget called Dar Luchtach. She is the one who comes. Well, first of all, there's an episode where she falls in love with a man and she tries to, she's in the same bed or with Bridget, and she tries to escape, and her, but she actually knows she's being wrong, and she kind of ends up walking on coals or something, and her feet get all burnt, and she doesn't go near the man anyway. That's the end of that. But she then reappears, and she's not in cogitosis, as far as I know. She's in the other life, the other early life, the Vita Prima, where Bridget is dying, and she says, "Oh, I want to die with you." And we have the same feast day, the 1st of February, and Bridget says, "No, you can die next year on the same day." Now, the interesting thing is that there are saints in Ireland have companion shadow saints, and Dar Luchtach is that shadow saint. And it means the daughter of Luchid, or the devotee of Luchid. And a few of our female saints have this Dar element, and a deity as the second part. And what I think is that what this is telling us, if we understand the importance of the Curra and that whole Fahart area as being a ceremonial centre of Leinster, that there was a cult site dedicated to Luch or Luchid in Kildare.
Who's he?
Luch, the great god. You know, he turns up everywhere. He turns up as a whole rash of saints as well. Malaga, of Tig Malaga. So he is Christianized. And I think whatever happens in Kildare and the conversion, it's the conversion of some cult site, potentially.
So it's the appropriation of what was there before.
Of what was there
into
before,
a Christian.
Potentially, yeah. Something to do with Loch. And the interesting thing, which I just realised about Scotland, that in Scotland, one of the few places where you have a round tower in Scotland worth a visit is Abernethy. And the tale, which is very early, about it's dedicated to St. Bridget. But the person who comes to the Pictish king to ask for the land for St. Bridget is Dar Luchtach. who is supposed to have come after her as abbess. So in all that is a kernel of the Christianization of Kildare. And it's all to do with the Fothert being the OPW and becoming Christianized themselves in this early period. At least that's what I'm beginning to think. It may be mad stuff, but...
Now, I want to go back to the point that Edel brought up there, which is, on the one hand, Patrick as a figure of authority and so on, and his story doesn't change that much from what you've just said. Bridget, on the other hand, it seems, is a more demotic, popular, maybe subversive even. For example, is this idea that she was the daughter of a slave, right? That she was close to the poor. You know, just expand that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of Bridget's cult. So in early Irish society, which is really hierarchical, it's really elitist, female slaves aren't even regarded as people, they're units of value. So one of the common ways that somebody's, what they would call their honour price or their status would be measured would be by saying, it's worth so many female slaves. And one female slave is worth three milk cows, basically. So, you know, we're not looking at a society which is really egalitarian when it comes to women at all. Now, what's really fascinating about those early texts with Bridget is that they identify her parents, Dovthach and Brigshach is her mother. They lean in very heavily to the idea that her mother is a slave, but that slave status is transcended by Bridget. And in the end, she's also able to free her mother through her acts of Christianization. And throughout the life, it very much attacks the non-elites. And so this is one of the lives, it's called the First Life of Bridget or the Vita Prima. It's a little bit of a theme in the other life that's been mentioned, cogitosis. But in this life, it's probably one of the major themes, which is that noble authority is awful, that noblemen are violent, that Irish society is full of violence against innocent people, basically. And in one amazing scene, Bridget says, well, the sons of kings are the sons of serpents and they're the sons of blood, except for a very few, and the ordinary people are better. You know, and a lot of her miracles involve her helping ordinary people get out of a jam, basically. So one of the famous ones that appears in both of the early lives is this ordinary man, accidentally, he kills the tame fox of a king. He's then imprisoned. His life is in danger. Bridget manages to miraculously persuade a wild fox to pretend to be tame. It's one of the first references to Bridget's cloak. So she's going across the Liffey in her chariot and she has the fox nestled under her cloak. And then the fox plays tricks. The man is freed and then the fox just runs off. So the king is left with nothing in the end. But this is the way she's presented. It's really subversive. Because if you look at a lot of other Irish lives, there's a very inbuilt assumption that it's the elites who matter. It's the conversion of the elites who matter. The one main conversion incident we have in this early life of Bridget is the conversion of an ordinary family, an ordinary farming family. So the difference between what's going on with Bridget now is this around her gender, for example? I mean, how does such a subversive text become so important? And it's one of the reasons, I think, fueling her popularity as well. There's no other Irish saint that behaves in the way Bridget does.
Is that a kind of a double-edged thing, though, right? Because on one hand, it's almost like a social welfare version of St. Bridget, even radical, you might say. But on the other is, it could be read as a conservative view of women as healers, as looking after people, as carers, like, almost, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a very fair reading. And I would say of those two early lives I mentioned, one of those lives actually, I think, flows in that direction. Mm-hmm. So the life by cogitosis, he sort of describes Bridget as doing work which is the work of women. And so it very much leans into that idea of maybe it's a domesticity angle. The other life, and she isn't shown really traveling a lot. In the other life, she's traveling everywhere. She's talking to kings. You have an undercurrent of disagreement between her and Patrick, for example, when they're brought together. And so they take the same sort of material, and one is quite conservative, as you mentioned, in the way it's presenting it, while the other is more radical. It's an example, though, of how her cult has so many different dimensions. you know, when you sort of drill into it in a bit more detail.
Now, I want to, Barbara, I want to go to you on going back to the you know, St. Bridget as a figure of the popular imagination. I just want to talk about various elements of folklore. I mean, I can remember as a child making Bridget's crosses. I mean, and it's amazing how such a tactile experience gives you a connection, which you never lose, you know.
Absolutely, indeed.
I mean, who's made Bridget's crosses here? Clearly everyone, right? I mean, talk to us about that.
Again, there are so many functions that attach to St. Bridget's Day in the way in which it was commemorated, and still is indeed in many parts of the country. And the making of St. Bridget's crosses would be a very good example of that, because for the most part, St. Bridget's crosses that were made the length and breadth of the country, they weren't earth-shatteringly amazing in artistic terms, but they did give people a real outlet for creativity, I think, which shouldn't be overlooked either. And the whole notion of, there was a whole plethora, there was a whole complex of traditions and practices and beliefs that were all intertwined, which had to do with the occasion of the 31st of January / the 1st of February. And again, I suppose, you know, we are to a certain extent dealing here not so much with historical fact and with the early literature and so on, although there is a fascinating interrelationship between many of the stories that circulated in oral tradition right up to the present day, certainly into the 20th century, and versions of the same stories that you sometimes do find in the early literature. And that gets extremely complicated and very, very difficult to disentangle. But many of the customs and practices and beliefs, I think, that we are familiar with today to do with St. Bridget, I think they can best be understood on the level of kind of metaphor and symbolism and so on. And I do think that while historical fact and research is obviously hugely important, at the same time, I think for traditional societies in the past, the whole idea of having this layer of lyricism, as I've called it before, attaching to people's lives, is something that shouldn't be underestimated either. I mean, there was a very strong belief, for example, which you find attaching to saints all over medieval Europe as well, that saints would actually revisit the earth on the occasion of the eve of their feast day, which was exactly what you got in the case of St. Bridget too, with people leaving out the Brath Regia overnight and that thereby acquiring curative properties and so on. But I mean, there is something quite magical about that. And I think that the function of beliefs and practices like that, as I say, it shouldn't be underestimated. And it was a very important part of people's lives, and it helped to, you know, brighten things up and give a sense of wonder, I suppose.
Barbara, what other ones are there? What other
I mean, again, you know, where do you start, really? I suppose maybe, unlike St. Patrick's Day in more recent years, in any case, St. Patrick's Day...
It's a bank holiday now, isn't it, Monday?
Exactly, and there is a kind of an inherent contradiction there as well in some ways, because St. Bridget's Day, of all of the four quarter days in Irish tradition, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, the beginning of each of the four seasons, St. Bridget's Day tended to be quite domestic in nature and quite intimate and quite a household kind of an affair. I mean, what it marked essentially was, as Kevin Danaher, who I'm sure many of you are very familiar with as well, has written about in his great book, The Year in Ireland, it was really the beginning of the kind of reawakening of, you know, the whole the world of nature, and the start of preparations for the spring sowing and the start of the whole agricultural round for the year again. And what's your question, Tommy?
No, they just have various traditions. You know, I'm thinking of the Bradbury, Billy
Boys. Absolutely.
You know.
Sorry, I was talking about the fact that many of the traditions are kind of domestic in nature and so on. But many of them, I mean, there's just so many of them, you know. Where do you start? There's the breed yoke tradition, which, again, I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with. This is something that is still very much alive and very much to the fore, especially in Inishmallon and the Aran Islands, where little girls go around on the evening of January the 31st again with a doll which is made anew every year, and they carry it from house to house, and they get either money or sweets or whatever it might be in return for having brought this blessing in the form of the doll from house to house. And a former student of folklore in UCD, indeed, A.D. Ní Hiarna, has done wonderful work in the last couple of years, you know, documenting this tradition, as other people have as well, and people from Inishmallon have done it too. But she's very interesting in talking about the fact that, you know, little girls are kind of at the bottom of the social hierarchy, I suppose, in most situations, and certainly traditionally they were. But just for this one evening, they are absolutely the top of the pipe. They are the most important people on Inishmallon. So you have Bridget's Day traditions. Again, the complexity of the whole thing. They operate and they function on such an interesting kind of a social level as well. It's a very beautiful tradition too. I mean, very visual. I'm always surprised that more interest hasn't been taken in it. But that's just one example. But then you had Biddy Boys in other parts of the country, and you had the Chris Regia as well, which
what
is...
What are the Biddy Boys?
Well, the Biddy Boys are the kind of part of a European house-visiting tradition, and a little bit akin, as you were also saying, Tommy, to the whole Wren Boy or Ran Boy tradition, where you'd have groups of people going around a particular area and usually performing something, whether it might be singing music or whatever, and... going from house to house and receiving some kind of food, drink, money, whatever it might be. I mean, it's a version of trick-or-treating, which we're all familiar with, obviously, on Halloween. And again, it has its own part to play in terms of social cohesion and so on.
I know, trick-or-treating and even like Ran Boys, and historically, there was always a kind of a slight coercive element to it. In other words, like, they come in and eat you out of house and home, like, right? And if you don't feed them, you know... they'll play a trick on you, like burn your house down or whatever, you know, in an extreme case.
Yeah, so. It went across the spectrum. I mean, there could be that element did certainly, you know, you found it on occasions and in some places. But I mean, the Inish man, the breed joke on Inish man would be very far removed from that, obviously.
What about the Brat Breeder? What's that?
The Brat Breeder, which I mentioned a moment ago, it's a garment, a piece of cloth of some kind, which is left out on the evening of January the 31st. So we should all have done it last night. And the belief was that St. Bridget, as I mentioned before, is believed to revisit the earth on the occasion of the 31st of January. And in passing by people's houses, she would then bless this garment. And the garment would then acquire a curative or a healing property, which could be used over the following year or indeed for a number of years. And that is one of the traditions attaching to St. Bridget, which I think is possibly coming back into popularity again, from what I can see. And whether this has to do with the kind of demise or the decline in Orthodox religion or not, I don't know. I think there's another interesting argument to be had there.
Now, what about her connection with beer?
Yeah, that's...
By the way, when I was doing a bit of picture research, I came across this amazing image, right? Basically with St. Bridget with a pint in one hand, a packet of tato in the other, right? But yeah. what's the
This is something that you don't find very much in the oral tradition. I think it's probably
beer is just, it's a part of, you know, early Irish society, and it's a part of the early Irish church. And there are so many stories about Bridget and beer and the lake of beer. And I mean, one of the important ones for me is that Cogitosis explicitly says, like Jesus at the wedding of Cana, she turned water into beer, right?
That's going to make her popular. Like,
but what's important there to me, why that's my favourite beer, Bridget beer story, again, there's loads of them from the very earliest sources, is because is that we didn't have vineyards in Ireland, so he just does a little twist on the story. You know, so many of the stories are inspired by biblical parallels and inspired by Christ, and she is very much portrayed as a Christ-like figure and also as Mary of the Gael. And he just straight away taps into his audience, to his constituency of rural agricultural Ireland and of the church, and of, we weren't using wine, it was beer. And I find that with a lot of the stories, that what makes the stories of Bridget so resonant with people. So all the stories to do with animals as well. Animals were a really important part of early Irish society, you know. They're mentioned in so many different ways in so many different texts. You know, there are law texts dedicated to dogs, law texts dedicated to cats, a law text dedicated to bees. You know, animals were a really important part of society. Obviously, cows and cattle and dairying and everything. There's so many things in relation to everything to do with dairy industry and everything. But it's placing her very clearly and plainly within this certain context. So she's, you know, part of that society. So I think that's, to me, that's one of the important parts of the beer, you know, in that it's recognisable to her audience.
And I suppose to add to that as well, Niamh, and I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head about how a lot of those miracles are working. They're locating her within that culture and society. There's another aspect to the beer as well, in that beer is associated with rulership. And in a way, you've on the one hand Bridget being very subversive about rulership, but in herself being given the imagery of a ruler. So, you know, turning water into beer is showing that authority she has. In one of the early lives, when her mother is pregnant with Bridget, the chariot she's in is described as resounding under a king. And it's a reference to Bridget. When she's born, there's a prophecy that a child will be born who will be really powerful. And there's a queen who's about to give birth, and they all think it's going to refer to her future son. But in fact, the prophecy refers to Bridget. And I think the beer imagery is flowing into that aspect of the Bridget cult as well. But yeah, it's very connected to how that society visualizes itself as well. And maybe that's one of the reasons it doesn't maybe occur in later folklore, because that element isn't present anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because what does occur, which is interesting, the broth, for example, occurs very early on. And there is also, she's regarded as the protector of the Leinster men. And she's kind of hanging over them in Cath Aluna, which is a probably 10th century tale of a battle between the Leinster men and the Inhale of the North. They come down to attack Leinster, and Colum Kill is protecting the Inhale, the Northerners, and Bridget is protecting the Leinster men. But that also is expressed in a very fine poem of probably the 9th century, where the poet is contrasting Kildare to Knockalling, the great site of royal site or assembly site of Leinster, and saying, oh, it's deserted. All the kings are now down in Kildare. That's where they are. And Bridget is watching over the Curragh and Kildare. So this idea of the broth.
And then in the art, it's depicted as physically her cloak and all her people.
Is it a story that she kind of threw a cloak?
What's
the origin of that one?
It's in. It appears in at least in the 11th century lives, and the way the story goes is that Bridget is looking for the land on which to found Kildare, and the King of Leinster says, "Oh, you know what? Put your cloak on the ground there, and that's the land you will get." And she puts the cloak on the ground, and of course, it spreads. Yeah. So it appears, you know, so it is part of that medieval tradition. And it's an example of something where, again, you can see a small kernel at the beginning, and then it gets bigger and bigger. Yeah.
And sorry, just on the whole subject of a broth as well, which, again, you know, there are so many aspects to it, but that, of course, is an international motif that you find in international folk tales as well. And it's also a story that you find in Virgil's Aeneid, except there it's attaching, as I'm sure you know, to the founding of Carthage by Dido. Yeah. Dido? Yes. Dido, I think it is. Isn't it? Not exactly the same story. It's actually an ox hide that Dido is believed to have used, and she actually cuts it into strips. But again, it's a way of kind of, I suppose, getting the upper hand on this very powerful local chieftain and getting a far bigger area of land than he'd originally intended, giving her. So all of the international connections.
And the Chris is the same, because you have the Chris Reader, which is protecting, and you have relics that are, you know, belts or so on, quite often to do with the safe birth. And you've got St. Margaret of Antioch, and particularly late medieval period, where women are giving birth and a kris or a belt is put around them for a safe birth. So that international element as well that you find in, material side of Bridget.
But it's all about women. You know, I think that's one of the biggest things about, you know, her popularity today and all through history, is that she is just representing so many things to do with women. And it's one of the things I think that's most important to me anyway about Bridget, is that she is a woman who founded one of the most powerful institutions in the country. And the women who followed her at Kildare, the subsequent abbesses at Kildare, they were, you know, commemorated in the Irish, the medieval chronicles, the annals, and they were often the most powerful woman in the country at the time, because as Elva has said, this was a highly hierarchical and patriarchal society. Women didn't have, you know, independent status and free agency. So what she achieved and the legacy that she achieved in the Middle Ages is just mind-blowing. But today, everything that I'm hearing, everything to do with Bridget and everything that you have been kind of said this evening and what Barbara was saying about the folklore and everything, is that what keeps being said to me is a feminine. She's the feminine, and it's women and girls of all generations talking about what Bridget means to them. And I don't know, so much I think about Bridget and her legacy is about the work of women in the community and the work. It's giving women a space or a freedom to be able to come together and, I don't know, partake in kind of traditional kind of maybe women's activities or whatever that might be. But what I'm really seeing now is younger women being able to say, she represents, now they might say different things to me, not the saint perhaps, but things like the sacred feminine or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what that means. But what's very clear is that what it means to them is kind of a feminine power or a feminine expression, or that she is just this great, we have so few female icons, we have so few kind of women kind of leaders that people can look up to, and that everything is being put into Bridget and that she is symbolizing that for people, you know, and that's how, you know.
So you mean you don't Bridget as a feminist icon then?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I think she is a brilliant feminist icon because she achieved something that, you know, was almost impossible for a woman to achieve in the Middle Ages, and it's nearly almost impossible today. I mean, how many women create a massive, hugely influential institution, you know, that goes on to, you know,
I mean, she, power. But from what you're saying earlier, she also has environmental credentials. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not just feminist, she's green. She's a green feminist.
But again, I think people latch on to that today because we're living in a modern, you know, postmodern and post-industrial, you know, technological society. So the way that she's depicted, you know, at one with the earth seems quite, you know, different to how we live now, but it would have been how everyone lived. They were all connected to, you know, this is in a world before electricity, you know, so everyone was concerned with the sun rising in the morning. They couldn't turn the lights on to...
The word imbolg, meaning pregnancy, isn't it? Imbolg. That's the festival. No. The festival of Imbolg. Isn't it now, no?
Well, there are different meanings to it. I mean, everybody takes it to be bullock, but it isn't necessarily bullock.
Milk, sometimes.
Milk, yes, it's doing milk, yeah, which would make far more sense, because I should point out that Imbolg being the 1st of February, the 2nd of February is Candlemas. So the fact that her feast day is the 1st of February and then the 2nd of February, Candlemas, does have some relationship. They do have some connection there. The other thing is that Imbolg isn't necessarily to do with Bridget. You know, it's to do with, as Barbara was saying, we associate it with the 1st of February. But Imbolg is one of those changes of season. Mm. So a lot of the miracles in the lives are to do with milk, for example. When she's born, she's born on the threshold, which is very much a thing that with the folklore tradition of, you know, being on the threshold or the breed oak being brought to the threshold. But then when she's born, the druid who has bought or rescued, really, Brixach, her mother, he takes the baby and washes her in milk. So she's very much of that season. Her birth is associated with that season and with, obviously, the whole new season of calving and so on. Mm. So that's where Imbolg, and I think it's Cormac MacQuillan as well, in his great glossary, gives three or four explanations.
Yeah, he does, and he's really interested in those quarter days as well,
yeah,
because he talks about Lunasa, he talks about Beltane,
and Samhain.
And,
yeah.
Samhain. Mm. And I mean, you can sort of see something similar with Samhain, I think, is what you're seeing with Imbolg, is that you've got these quarter day festivals. And sometimes I think the feast days of saints can be attracted to those festivals. Mm. So a great example is Halloween.
Yeah.
And when you think of it, you've got your All Saints, your All Souls and so on. And if you look at, say, Irish listings of saints, a huge number get attracted on to the 31st of October, more so actually, and then on to the 1st of November. And you're seeing something similar. I haven't looked at the Lunasa and the Beltane. You're getting it in Imbolg as well.
Yeah, and it's very much to do with the agricultural cycle. So it's dry cattle and the reduction in milk yield, and then the beginning of the increase in milk yield. And then it's to do with, as you were saying, sowing, you know, the crops. Lunacy is very much the, you know, the ripening of the crop. And interestingly, the saints that are attracted, are associated with that period, all, loads of them have a low element in them. So St. Malaga, there's Lochtina, they all have a Malua, they all have a something to do.
Well, and that's what happens a lot, is one big day will attract others into their orbit. So the quarter days are a really good example of that. Also something which isn't related, say like St. Patrick's Day on the 17th, that attracts a whole bunch of saints in who are related to Patrick. The same with Columbkilla, again, the saints are attracted in. Mm-hmm. So you find that happening quite a lot, but the quarter day ones are actually very interesting. And the Imbolc one is sort of your first one out the door in some ways. It's the season of growth.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what
And then
saying.
That's reflected in the folklore.
Very much so. And sorry, just on the specific term Imbolc as well, it's something that you find exclusively in the medieval literature, in the early literature, and you don't find it in the hundreds and probably possibly thousands of pages of information on St. Bridget that you have in the archives of the National Folklore Collection. I mean, the word Imbolc hasn't been used by any normal person, like since the 12th century or whatever it is. It's not something that you find in current use. Like
exactly. And it becomes less relevant.
Yes. Yeah.
I wonder if there's a bit of a disassociation between nature in the 19th and 20th century in the Catholic Church. Because I was thinking about, I grew up in Listowel in North Kerry and we have a harvest festival, but it was never reflected in the church. And ironically, it was reflected in the Church of Ireland. You know, a friend of my father's looking for wheat to put on the altar during it. So I felt that the link had been kind of broken in one sense. And it was only when I went to Italy and I saw St. Francis of Assisi and realised his association with animals that I began to see that some saints got a bit of the heave-ho, and the ones that were kind of, you know, elevated were people like St. Teresa of Lisieux. And the nature side of it had been subdued rather.
I think you've actually got to a very important point there, which is that Christianity changes an awful lot. Yeah. So when we're looking at the Christianity of, say, the time of Bridget, and then we get to the 19th, and actually that's a very good point that you've identified as well. Christianity just changes so much that it's almost unrecognisable. Mm. So what people are doing in the 5th, 6th, 7th century is not at all like what they're doing later. And you're right, there is a break in that tradition. And also it's always worth remembering that there's huge upheavals in Ireland. There's huge social upheavals, linguistic upheavals. You know, there's loss of the Irish language in large parts of the country. Obviously not so much in Kerry now, but, you know, there is that loss as well. So there's just enormous change.
Yes.
I think you've identified something quite important there.
It's quite interesting when, if you go back to the 17th century, the period of the Counter-Reformation, Bridget is depicted by John Colgan, for example. Our colleague John McCafferty has spoken about this as an almost like a Teresa of Avila. She's in the garb of a Counter-Reformation nun. And then, as Elva says, once you come to the 19th century and the transformation of the Catholic Church in Ireland, basically with the change and the foundation of Maynooth, then you go into really the internationalisation of saints. To a certain extent, at a local level, I think the old ones survive. I mean, I come from Dalkey in County Dublin, and Begnet has survived all the way through to this day, even though she's not very prominent, but she is prominent in Dalkey. And the people of Dalkey to this day would go to the church.
Yeah, very similar to what I'd have experienced. Like, I'm from Limerick, but my family, a lot of us from East Clare. So St. Senan is still, the wells are all there still. And what's interesting is in some places, the wells get renamed. And so they often get named Patrick after Patrick, and the older names get lost. But then, as you say, in other places, they really they really hang on and the tradition remains vibrant. I mean, I remember going as a kid to St. Senan's Well, near where my family would be from, in Conlara. And it, supposedly it would get rid of the warts that I'm afraid were covering my hands at the time. And they didn't. I'm afraid to say I ended up using probably extremely dangerous chemicals. But yeah, that tradition was still alive. And there was another well that was associated with curing eyesight. Yeah.
Finian's Well in Clonard, yeah, does cure warts.
Does it? Really? Did it just go to the wrong well?
It does. You have to go to Finian's Well in
Clonard. Are you in the favourite well?
Absolutely. I was just going to hop in there as well, because talking about holy wells, and especially holy wells dedicated to St. Bridget, you have, of course, the wonderful St. Bridget's Well in Clondalkin. What I really love about that is that it's literally within a stone's throw of Newlands Cross, which is probably not just the busiest junction in Dublin, I think it's true, it's probably the busiest junction in the country, or at least one of them. And it's right bang in the middle of a housing estate. We don't know how old it is, but there seems to be a fair bit of evidence to suggest that some of the structures around it were built probably in the 1760s, I think it is, to be 18th century, obviously. But, I mean, there is every possibility that the well goes back long before that, except we don't have the evidence to prove it. But, again, I think it's a fantastic aspect of folklore, in that you have this most unexpected, I suppose. I mean, it does seem that it's kind of this an incongruity, I suppose, in some ways. It's just so far removed from people's ideas of what a holy well is like and where it would be, which would be situated in the far reaches of the west of Ireland, preferably in an Irish-speaking area, but certainly someplace that's far removed from, you know, urban conglomerations of the type that you get in Clondalkin. And yet it's there and it's thriving and it's so well looked after by the people of Clondalkin. It's just great to have it surviving as this little piece of medieval practice still going strong.
The fire pit in the beside the cathedral there in Kildare, and this thing of the fire in her monastery.
Yes.
Is that about?
Yes. Well, it's Giraldus Cambrensis who comes up with that first.
But Catherine McKenna presented a really interesting paper at Utrecht at the Celtic Congress last summer, and she thinks that it was the Augustinian, the New Order in Kildare in the 12th century. That was her theory anyway, that they started the fire or something, but we don't have any references to the fire until Giraldus Cambrensis.
Well,
they multiply, you start getting fires out in Inishmurray, you know, various places, you end up with lots of sacred fires.
Yeah, but it's not a earlier medieval.
That's as early as it is. Now, we can't tell. I actually looked down into the so-called fire, the perpetual fire, and I would love to go down into it because it looks as if it's some sort of structure or the foundations of something which could be a medieval, late medieval foundation.
But nothing has really been excavated.
It's very difficult to excavate because it's a burial ground.
And it's a vibrant town.
Yeah, just a question there at the back.
How uncommon in early Christianity is it to have a female saint like Bridget to hold such a legacy of veneration? Like, is that really uncommon? Especially at that time.
I would sort of make, I suppose, it's actually quite uncommon, okay? So, you know, you get a scattering of them. They tend to be well known because of their rarity in a way. Just to give you some figures at you. I was, over the last few years, I've been working on this database of Irish saints. And in that, only 12% of them are women.
Yes.
And that's actually way better than the percentage of lives or texts that are written about them, which is much smaller. So yes, it is pretty uncommon. But one of the things which is interesting, it's more common at a point when a country is maybe undergoing that transition to Christianity. Mm. Women have a greater importance during that period, maybe because they're seen as maybe mothers of the next generation or for various reasons. And you actually sort of see early women, you see it like in the early centuries of Christianity on the continent as well. You see early women who are quite influential and important, but as the church becomes bigger and more institutionalized, it actually tends to fade away and women become less important.
Yes.
So you sort of tend to see that happening as well.
Yes, and a lot of them would be mothers of great saints. So I'm thinking in Wales, St. David's mother, Non, she is, you know, one of the big saints of Wales. But again, she disappears behind her son.
And then there's poor old Dárka, the supposed sister of Patrick. Is the mother of what, sort of 17 kids, yep. And most of them bishops.
And
that's sort of really crazy.
And one of them gets killed, doesn't she, by a chariot?
Because she commits a sin. Yeah.
Sin, yes.
Yeah. Better jump in quick here before these... Yeah.
Sorry, I was going to say it's easy for us to look back at her as a feminist today, but of course all of the texts that have been written about her would have been written by men, so yeah. We're kind of viewing her through the lens of the patriarchy. So I guess my question would be how prevalent would it be for a woman in that time to really relate to her on a personal level and kind of be proud of her as this symbol of femininity?
But the texts were written by men, but copied by men as well, most likely. And, you know, it's like so many copies, especially Cogitosis. I think Jean-Michel's up to 85.
Not necessarily all copied by men. I mean, there's been a lot of recent work showing that women as scribes are actually far more important than they've been given credit for. Yeah. So the copying, you're making a very good point. Yes, the vast majority of texts we have are written by men. One of the things that's important to look at is the audience of a text. Sometimes the language will tell you something about that. The variety of genres that a text is written in might give you a sense of their popularity. Later on, as you go further into time and you begin to see women emerging as patrons, again, they mightn't be writing the texts, but they're very important in terms of what they're giving those churches. And they're not going to give it unless there's something in it for them as well, I think.
Well, you can see, for example, a queen who has a very interesting career, Lond, in the 9th century, where it is a late source, but it says that she directs a church to be built at Kildare, a wooden church. So she probably is the earliest woman patron that we can see. Yeah. And also in the early 10th century, Muireann, who is the abbess of Kildare, they have captured the King of Munster, or a joint King of Munster, and he's been handed back to Munster, his own people. And Muireann is at the head of the great procession with the clerics behind her with their shrines and relics and whatever, and they conduct him, but she conducts him to the border between Leinster and Munster. So she's visible.
Very much so. And there's that famous, well, you know, famous is such a relative word, isn't it? As I say, obscure point, and then I say famous. There's a reference in the early Irish law tracts to the Abbess of Kildare, somebody who can hold back the streams of war. And I think it goes to your point that they're playing this diplomatic role as well. Yeah. So there's women in Kildare, and interestingly enough, In the early Middle Ages, you get many churches founded that are what we call double monasteries. So they're half male and they're half female. And what tends to happen as time goes on and the church becomes maybe more conservative about this, they become frowned upon because they're seen as occasions for sin, basically. Mm-hmm. In most Irish cases, those double monasteries become monasteries for men. Yes. So St. Ida of Killeedy is a really good example of that. But if you look at Kildare, it's the female house that predominates. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking at is an audience, the patrons, probably the people who are getting those lives copied and recopied, creating that new literature. Mm-hmm. So I think it is difficult, and I think it's a very valid point you're making. But I think there's ways of reading against the grain of the sources and trying to find, is there a woman's voice there? Is there a female experience that we can look at or in a way or think about?
Now, before we finish, I just want to touch on what's the most obvious legacy of St. Bridget, which is the name itself, right? Mm-hmm. And its various forms, Bridget, Bridie, Bridge, Bride, any more. I mean, do we have any figures for how popular a name it was? I know that, 100 years ago, people used a lot less names before it became fashionable in suburban Dublin to call your child some obscure old Gaelic name, right? Like, so, I mean, what percentage of women were called Bridget? How many Bridgets are there in the audience? Just, as a, not sure. I know there's one there.
One, two.
My life's partner.
I think the name is going to come back now with the new public.
Well, my middle name is Breeze. Okay.
We all have Breeze, it as a confirmation name. Yeah.
No, but there's also pejorative side, because it just says, there was Paddy or Mick, there was Bridget.
Sure,
it was a kind of generic name for Irish women. And you had the recent book by Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormick on Bad Bridget, about all the Bridgets who went off the rails in various ways. So, I mean, do we know like how common a name it was?
I think that in the recent past, the first names, Christian names that people had, tended to be pretty much the same from one family to another. Yeah. And Mary and Anne and Bridget... Mm. And probably Kathleen as well, or some form of that, were actually very common for girls. But I was reading something on this recently. I can't remember the exact figure. I was quite surprised to see that something in the region of 10%, and this would be, I think, in the early 20th century. Now, I'm very, very vague in the details of this. I was surprised at the lowness of the figure, I must say. I would have thought it was more popular. But like Bridget herself, who, you know, mustn't know what has hit her in recent years because there's this huge upsurge of interest in her again. But I feel that there has been a certain rise in popularity in very recent years in the name Bridget too. And then, of course, you have, like, you have Brigitte Bardot and all kinds of people. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of glamorous, you know, glamorous Bridgets out there as well, I suppose, which probably improved its status.
Well, it's interesting that in the early period, you don't have women called Bridget.
You don't, and actually the most common name for a female saint, by a long way, is Lothar.
Lothar, yeah.
Give me that again.
Lothar. Flame. Fire. It's the most common name by a good way. Then you get names like Kier, like in Kerry, Kieriga, Crone, Lothar, variations of Lothar.
And queens have different names.
And they have different names.
Is really popular.
It's just not that many.
Gormla.
No, there aren't. No.
Now, any more questions with the audience before we... Yeah, here we go. Just wave the mic here.
After all the lovely information we've had this evening, and thank you very much, I want to ask a very trivial question. Was Bridget drop-dead gorgeous looking?
There's been so many...
No man could ask that question.
I was being asked by the British Embassy to try and come up with an image of Bridget for a interactive virtual... Anyway, it's not happening, but... I've been trying to think long and hard what would Bridget have looked like. But and then there was a Twitter thread on her ex, formerly Twitter, last couple of days, Aidan O'Sullivan, we should be picturing her, first of all, age-wise. I mean, it's all about inner beauty shining through. So obviously she was a gorgeous individual. And, she was a gorgeous individual. Everybody loved her from all times. But, the depictions of her are quite amusing. She's kind of like this... 18-year-old with massive red hair and voluptuous body and all this kind of thing. I mean, we should be imagining her as a very, an authoritative woman, definitely a mature woman, maybe 50 or 60. Thinking of, you'd have to be thinking about what women were like in the 5th century, And
well, just on the question, the figures in the annals for her age, I mean, is it credible that she died at 85?
Yeah, there's loads of...
Well, from the archaeological point of view, women can live quite late because there's a wonderful site which is excavated by my colleague Betty O'Brien up in Donegal, in Ballymac Ward, which consisted of women only, which is very, very interesting. And some of them were definitely lived into their 60s, 70s.
And wasn't there an example, if I remember correctly, of a woman who had severe arthritis?
Yes, yes.
She lived to quite a,
she did.
Quite a good age. So
yeah, and she was cared for. So it is possible.
If you were a man, it wasn't great, though.
Christian life as well, and you're not going too hard on the...
On the beer.
Booze and the...
I think just on her age, I think it's true to say that far more people died at a younger age in the past. I mean, quite recently.
Oh, yeah.
But those who didn't die at a younger age...
If they got
Childbirth
was the big one.
If you got through those two things...
Yeah, I mean, it's when you look at those
25, why isn't that extraordinary,
Yeah.
Well, that's where it raises another question. I mean, was she sexually active?
No.
How do you know?
We don't know. I don't know.
There's no reference to that at all.
Well, she's a famous virgin. She was chaste.
They emphasise that. But look, it's one of those
Christian
things.
Tradition.
You can never tell. Because there is the question, there's the tale in one of them or both, where she does the classic thing that her father wants her to marry
and she pulls out
her eye and,
liquefies in one version. It's one of those images I never really want to
think about. But, one thing about it is that, women... and men who, at the period of conversion, you know, when a society was being converted, they are converts, so they can be quite extreme in their lifestyle for that very reason, to show that they have changed religion, and that you do find men and women. Peter Brown, the great historian, has written about this and about virginity and chastity. It's almost a symbol.
Yeah, it is. They go gung-ho. A really great example of that is Colin Bannis.
Colin Bannis, yeah.
And Colin Bannis is extreme.
Oh, totally.
I mean, I always imagine them, I mean, completely unhistorically, getting out their champagne in Bangor when he leaves, popping the corks and saying, thank God that man has gone.
Listen, I think we're going to have to wrap up there. Obviously, the story of Bridget is going to run and run. I'd just like to thank our panel here, Edel Brannock, Elva Johnston, Niamh Witcherly, Barbara Neilin, and I'd like to thank Keith, the sound man in the business. I'd like to thank you all for coming along, particularly those people who made a contribution from the floor.
We are having a big conference in September in Maynooth University. Everybody is welcome. The 13th to the 15th of September. Elva's going to be speaking at it, and perhaps Edel as well, if your schedule allows. And we have Professor Catherine McKenna from Harvard, and we have very many other people who are going to be presenting papers on St. Bridget, on the early history of Bridget and of Kildare.
So I'd just like to thank everyone for coming along, and I hope to see you at the next Hedge School. Thank you.